Our passage this evening comes from 2 Samuel chapter 13. This is not a passage that's widely familiar, perhaps. I think it's well that we read it all to get it in front of us. So we'll read the whole chapter. Be sure we have it down. 2 Samuel chapter 13. Here's what happened afterwards. Absalom, son of David, had a beautiful sister. Her name was Tamar. And Amnon, son of David, loved her. And Amnon was so tormented because of Tamar, his sister, as to make himself sick. For she was a virgin, and to Amnon it seemed difficult to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend. His name was Jonadab, son of Shammah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very skillful man. And he said to him, "Why are you so down, O son of the king, morning after morning? Will you not tell me?" Then Amnon said to him, "It's Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. I love her." So Jonadab said to him, "Lie down on your bed and make like you're sick. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, 'Please let Tamar, my sister, come and give me food to eat. And she shall make the food in my presence so that I can see and eat it when she serves me.'" So Amnon lay down and made like he was sick. When the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, "Please let Tamar, my sister, come and make cakes in my presence, a couple of cakes that I might eat while she serves me." So David sent to Tamar at her house, saying, "Please go to the house of Amnon, your brother, and make some food for him." Tamar then went to the house of Amnon, her brother, and he was lying down. And she took the dough and kneaded it and made cakes in front of him. And she cooked the cakes. Then she took the pan and flipped out the cakes in his presence, and he refused to eat. Then Amnon said, "Make everyone leave me alone." So everyone got out. Then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food into the bedroom, and I can eat while you serve me." So Tamar took the cakes she had made and brought them to Amnon, her brother, in the bedroom. When she brought it close to him to eat, he grabbed her and said to her, "Come in, go to bed with me, my sister." And she said to him, "No, my brother, do not abuse me, for such a thing is not to be done in Israel. Do not do this wickedness. And I, where could I take my disgrace? And you will be like one of the godless wretches in Israel. Now please speak to the king, for he will not hold me back from you." But he refused to listen to her, and he was stronger than she, and abused her and laid her. Then Amnon hated her with a very intense hatred. In fact, the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. So Amnon said to her, "Get up, get out." And she said to him, "No, because this evil is greater than the other you've done with me in sending me away." But he refused to listen to her. And he called his lad, his servant, and said, "Please get this out from me," and bolt the door behind her. She had on a tunic with long sleeves, for those were the robes the royal virgin daughters wore. And his servant put her out and bolted the door behind her. And Tamar put ashes on her head, tore the long sleeved tunic she had on, put her hand on her head, and went along screaming. And Absalom, her brother, said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? For now, my sister, be silent. He is your brother. Do not let your heart dwell on this thing." So Tamar stayed, desolate as she was, in the house of Absalom, her brother. And King David heard about all these matters, and he was very angry. Now Absalom did not speak at all to Amnon, either bad or good, for Absalom hated Amnon because of how he had humiliated Tamar's sister. Now 2 years later, Absalom had sheep shearers working at Baal Hatzor, which is in Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom had gone in to the king and said, "Look, your servant has sheep shearers at work. Might the king and his servants come with your servant?" And the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, let us not all go, that we may not prove a burden on you." And he pressed him about it, but he refused to go and yet gave him his blessing. Then Absalom said, "If not, may my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said, "Why should he go with you?" Now Absalom pressed him about it, so he sent Amnon and all the king's sons with him. And Absalom had commanded his young fellows, saying, Note now when Amnon's heart is jovial with wine. And when I shall tell you, strike down Amnon, you shall kill him. Don't be afraid. Am I not the one who's commanded you? Be strong and be gutsy men. So Absalom's young fellows did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons got up and rode, each on his mule, and fled. Now they were still on the road when a report reached David saying, Absalom has struck down all the king's sons, and there's not one of them left. So the king got up and tore open his clothes and lay on the ground, and all his servants were standing there with torn clothes. Then Jonadab, son of Shema, the brother of David, answered and said, Let not my lord think all the young men, the king's sons, have died, for Amnon alone is dead, for by the order of Absalom it has been determined from the day he humiliated his sister Tamar. And now do not let my lord the king take this matter so gravely, thinking all the king's sons have died, for only Amnon is dead. Now Absalom had fled, and the watchman lifted up his eyes and looked, and indeed there were a large number of people coming from the road behind him from the side of the hill. And Jonadab said to the king, See, the sons of the king have arrived. As your servant stated, so it has happened. When he had finished speaking, why, the sons of the king came in, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And the king too and all his servants wept with very bitter weeping. But Absalom had fled, and he went to Talmai, son of Ammihud, king of Geshur, and David mourned over his son continually. And Absalom fled and went to Geshur, and he was there 3 years. And this held King David back from going out against Absalom, but he consoled himself over Amnon since he was dead. Take you to 1960 and to the World Series in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. There was that moment in this was the seventh game of the World Series. It was tied at 3 games apiece, and the New York Yankees were ahead of the Pittsburgh Pirates 7-4. And it was the bottom of the eighth, and the Pirates had one man on, and there was a ground ball hit the shortstop. And Tony Kubek began to field it, or thought he would. It was a short double play ball. And on the third bounce, it hit a pebble or a clod of dirt or something and bounced over his glove and struck him right in the Adam's apple. And Kubek went down, grasping his throat, trying to breathe and so on and all of that. Well, everybody was safe. It wasn't so significant in itself, but everybody who recalls that game and writes about it says that was the turning point. Eventually, Pittsburgh won in the ninth inning, 10-9, but that was the turning point. Everything, even though the Yankees were ahead 7-4, everything went downhill from that point on. It was a sort of a hinge point, and that's what you have in 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. Those chapters are the turning point in David's regime and reign. And especially chapter 12, verses 10 to 12, where Yahweh had said to David, I am raising up against you evil from your own house. And now, in chapter 13, you see the evil begin. That was a turning point. Now, some people would object, of course, to this kind of narrative being made visible and dealt with in church. They think it's too delicate, etc., etc. You know, all the arguments and so on. I would just have to disagree with them. Why shouldn't we deal with these texts in the church? In the providence of God, these texts are in Holy Writ. What are they there for if we're not to deal with them and face them? Surely we can't be more prissy than God. So we deal with it. It's the next text. Now, we're readers and we're hearers of this story, aren't we? Well, it's difficult to know how to approach it in order to break it up and try to get it in front of the Lord's people. So, now, let's be what we are. We're readers or we're hearers of this story. And what activities, let's come at it that way, what activities does the writer seem to want us to engage in with this story? Well, first, he wants us to be hearing a story of calamity, verses 1 to 22. We're to be hearing a story of calamity, because that's what it is. Now, in one sense, Absalom is the focus, verse 1, and will be the focus of the next chapters and so on. But then the immediate focus turns on Amnon, who is the oldest son of David. And, of course, this this whole story in verses 1 to 22. We don't have time to go into it, but it's very carefully packaged. It's very, the structure of the story is very carefully laid out and very carefully told and put together. But we may think, looking at verse 1, that it's a love story. Though we're a little bit concerned because it says Amnon, her brother, loved Tamar. He was a half-brother, so on. But when we get to verse 2, we know there's some kind of a storm brewing because he loved her and he was tormented over her, so made himself sick. But then it says, for she was a virgin, and to Amnon it seemed difficult to do anything to her. He had no contact or access to her, apparently, but that bothers us. It doesn't take much imagination to think what he wanted to do and what he had in mind. Well, he has a friend, Jonadab, a nephew of David, who's willing to serve as a pimp. He has a plan. He notices that Amnon is down, kind of depressed and in the dumps. And he asks him about it. And Amnon says, oh, it's Tamar, my sister. I'm in love with her, and so on. And so Jonadab, in verses 5 and 6, has a plan. You just pretend to be sick. The king comes to see you. You ask him to send Tamar to do some cooking for you and to feed you, etc. And even you, Amnon, are smart enough to figure out what to do then. That seems to be the import. Well, so that happens, and Tamar comes at David's request and is working like a beaver in verse 8, getting the food ready and so on. And then comes the trap, Amnon sends everybody out. He asks her to bring the food in and feed him as he's reclining in bed, etc., or sitting up in bed. And it's then that he grabs her and so on. And everything, as we might say, goes downhill from there. Now, the problem here is that it was not only rape on Amnon's part, which is shameful enough. It was also, in terms of Old Testament law, incest, because half-brothers, or half-sister, however you want to put it, were not to have sexual relations. You see it in Leviticus chapter 18, verses 9 and 11. Tamar and Amnon were children of different mothers, but the same father. And that was a prohibited relation. So it was incestual rape that Amnon perpetrated here. And you might say, well, that's the case. Why did Tamar plead when she was pleading with him? Why did she say, speak to the king because he won't hold me back from you? If it was an illegal relation, why would she say something like that? Because she's so desperate in the heat of the moment, she resorts to any kind of argument she can think of, whether it's logical or not. She's scared out of her wits. She's fighting for her life and for her purity. And so she even brings that up. The king might be soft enough to let us marry or whatever. But it was a prohibited union and it was rape. And then you notice the sad center of the story in verses 14 and 15. He's stronger than her, and he laid her. And then you have a very revealing psychological result, don't you, in verse 15. And then he hated her. Lust can be like that. There's a fine line between lust and hate, and you notice that the Bible recognizes that psychological insight. So that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And he had two words for her, up, out, two words in Hebrew, get up, get out. And she countered him that was wrong as well, etc. and so on. But then he said to his servant, boy, please get this out from me. I know some of your translations have this woman, but there's no woman in the text. It's just this.
as if she's a bag of garbage that you put out at the curb. Get this out from me.
And bolt the door behind her. Well, that's hearing a story of calamity, and we're supposed to hear that. Now, why, one thing we have to ask, why does the writer tell you this story this way? Think about verses 1 to 22. Where does the writer want your sympathies to lie? He wants you to be pro-Tamar. That's what he wants. He wants you to see what dire straits and what a sad, despicable affair she has been placed, put through, etc. He wants to stir your sympathies that way. What impression does he want to make on you? He wants to make you nauseous. He wants to bring you to the point of nausea. He wants you, by this description, to despise the perversity of this sin. Which answers an objection we sometimes hear. And people say, oh, that's the Old Testament. More dirty stories. This is not a dirty story. If you think this is a dirty story, you haven't been listening to it. You haven't understood the writer's intent in telling you this and the way he's told it. It's anything but a dirty story. He's telling you what happened. He's not endorsing what happened. Quite the opposite. He's trying to bring you to the verge of vomiting. That's what he's trying to do. Now that, as we hear this story, that also brings up a problem of our own. There's a clear danger for us in hearing such a story, because there's a kind of perversity inside me and inside you that finds such a story rather fascinating, even interesting and absorbing. That's just the way it is. Back in 1979 in Jackson, Mississippi, there was a big flood when the reservoir in Pearl River flooded the whole area of Jackson, and there were homes that were standing in 5 and 6 feet of water and so on and all of that. And they had to warn people not to drive over there just to sightsee. Why? Well, there were some people. They weren't going over there to work or to help. They were going over to see how bad it was. There's something about seeing houses in 6 feet of water and seeing how bad it satisfies your curiosity. There's something in us like that. Why is it when you're going down the interstate and there's been a bad accident and so on, but the roadway has been cleared in both lanes and everything's off to the side and so on, but traffic's still backed up because practically every motorist that goes by there has to go slow and gawk to see how badly mangled things or people might be. There's a certain curiosity and attraction to that. There's a kind of inbuilt perversity in us. And I think that's a reaction we may have here if we're not careful. I mean, you find this far more interesting than you would find a report of a flu epidemic at a Goodyear tire shop in which two of the mechanics had to be hospitalized. That doesn't fascinate you as much as hearing about Amnon's lust. This is a story about illicit sex. And sometimes, yes, it's written so that we'll despise it. But in a way, it kind of fascinates us. And that should reveal yourself to you. So hearing a story of calamity. Now, secondly, I think the writer wants us to be assessing a cast of characters. Assessing a cast of characters. Now, in this story, we see how at every point people are in the wrong. I don't think Tamar's in the wrong. She was not sinning, but sinned against. But the whole cast of characters, the other characters, the main characters involved, there's always something erect there. Take Amnon. We don't need to spend much time on him. But Amnon, you could describe as passion without love. You see, as we've mentioned already, how lust and hatred can go together very well. And not to moralize, but you can say, can't you, that if you're a woman from, say, 13 to 43, and if you have a fellow that seems to be more interested in your body than in you, you should show him the highway and fast. But here is Amnon, full of lust. It's as if he sang to Jonadab, "But Jonadab, what can I do with my hormones?" And it's all the worse, isn't it, in our own time, when it's not just men, but in this case we're looking at men, have access to a plethora of pornography. Passion without love is what you see in Amnon. I remember a young lady who was probably in her high 30s, distressed over the direction her father's life had taken. And when she was speaking to me, she rather earthily described him by saying, "His brains are between his legs." That's Amnon. That's a good description of Amnon, passion without love. But then there's Jonadab, isn't there? We could call him wisdom without principle. You know, back in verse 3, it says literally, Jonadab was a very wise man. That's literally a very wise man. And we've translated it skillful, or some translations have crafty and so on. Not wise in a moral sense necessarily, but wise in the sense of knowing how to be successful to get things done. He was sharp. Let's put it that way. That was Jonadab. And he's more dangerous than Amnon. And more scary than Amnon. His evil is more multidimensional. He gets things done. He knows the ropes about how to operate. He's amoral. But unlike Amnon, you might say, he has a mind. And that makes him more dangerous. Jonadab is sort of the man who could come to your Christian school and hold a seminar for your teachers and argue the case for integrating faith and learning and help them to know how to teach from a Christian world and life view. And at the same time, he could also tell you how to get a scrumptious female into bed with you. That's Jonadab. Wisdom without principle. It reminds me of that story that Lyndon Johnson used to tell of the fellow who came to the Texas Hill Country during the Depression. So we're back in the 1930s or so. And this fellow wanted a teaching job, and jobs were hard to get then. But he seemed to put himself forth well. He was, buzzword, articulate. He was well-read, etc., and the board of the people were very impressed. So it came time for the kind of the last go-round of the interview, apparently, and they told him, you know, we really like you. We like what we've heard. We're very impressed. We think we would like to retain your services, but there's a debate among some of us, and we want to know where you stand on it. And they said, now there are some of us who believe that the earth is basically round, but there are others of us who believe that the earth is flat, and we want to know where you stand on that. And without batting an eye, he said, "I can teach it either way. Doesn't matter. Truth doesn't matter. I need the job. I'll do it whichever way you want." That's sort of Jonadab, without principle. Wisdom without principle. And Jonadabs can be a danger in the church, in that those with the greatest gifts can pose the gravest threat if those gifts are not wrapped in godliness. That's Jonadab. But then there's also David, isn't there? Amnon, Jonadab, David. David, anger without justice, verse 21. Now, there may be some of your translations that have a longer verse 21. I don't think that's the best text. I think the shorter text simply reads, King David heard about all these matters and he was very angry. I think that's the best text of verse 21. Well, that's good. He hears about all. He hears about how Amnon really used him. He hears about how he raped Tamar forcibly. And he hears about what all of this that Jonadab has done and how she was screaming in the streets and how she's now in Absalom's house and so on. And he's very angry. So that's good. He's very angry, but that's bad because that's all he does. He doesn't do anything more. Amnon is still unpunished. Tamar is unvindicated and ignored. And Absalom is still a seething vigilante, going to take action on his own because David was very angry, but he did nothing. You might say, well, after his adultery with Bathsheba and his wiping out Uriah in chapter 11 and so on, he kind of dissolved any moral authority he had. Yes, he did, but he's still the head judge of the nation. And whether he eroded seemingly by his own example his moral authority, still has a responsibility to act in this case, and he did nothing. What could he have done? Well, I don't know. I think he could have made plain to Amnon, you're the oldest son, but there's no way you're going to succeed to the throne. He could have said that. And then, according to Leviticus chapter 18, where these incestual relations are prohibited, it says in Leviticus 18 verse 29 that those who engage in this will be cut off from their people. Now, there's a debate about what that means. Does that mean that they are banished by the authorities from the community of Israel? Or most seem to think that to be cut off from their people was a direct judgment of God that he imposed, that he brought about on them. In either case, David could have at least pointed out that Amnon was in that status because of his action. But there was nothing that he did. And then there's Absalom. Hatred without reserve. Verse 22 and so on. He didn't speak at Amnon, either good or bad. He hated Amnon, and he bided his time for 2 years. And in verses 23 to 39, you have the result of that. When at the party of the sheep shearers and so on, Absalom had his thugs wipe out Amnon and kill him. And then, of course, he fled. It tells you three times in the last part of the chapter that Absalom fled. He hardly fled into hardship. Yes, he was out of the land of Israel, but he went to Geshur, which is northeast of what we call the Sea of Galilee, where his maternal granddaddy was the king of a kingdom there. Oh, he was well taken care of. But here is this 2 years, and he murders then his older brother. Now, what are we to do with this? I think the characters are put here for us to assess a cast of characters. But with this assessment, I think, as you look at it and you back away from it, and I have to watch how far I back here. It can be treacherous. You back away from it and look at all of them, and you're tempted to say, you know, there is none righteous. No, not one. The whole cast here is corrupt, or at least deficient. And these are the royals. These are the folks who are ordering and running, as it were, the kingdom. It's as if Isaiah 1 comes to mind. The whole head is sick. The whole heart faint. Everybody's in the wrong. That's the assessment. Affairs in what looks like God's kingdom can be like this. How dismal this looks. How can this in any way be part of the kingdom of God that he's bringing into the world? How dismal. Well, you know, we've just celebrated last year the Protestant Reformation, 500 years. This is the 501th year now. And you remember, do you, some of the conditions prior to the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation? Let me just remind you, in one case, of the Roman Church at that time. There was growing immorality among all classes of the clergy. For instance, in many places, people were delighted when they saw that their local priest was keeping a mistress. He wasn't supposed to do that. He had a vow of chastity, etc. He wasn't supposed to do that. That was illegal, etc., etc. But they were glad if they saw that the priest kept the mistress, because that meant that he wouldn't be trying to seduce the married women in the community. That's what it was like. Or there's Rodrigo Borgia, who had lived with a Roman lady. And then he continued the same illicit connection with one of her daughters, by whom he had five children. Borgia was a cardinal and an archbishop. And living in Rome with this illicit companion and other women, and the papal throne became vacant. Apparently the previous pope died. So he bribed certain other of the cardinals so that they would vote for him, and he became Pope Alexander VI, reigning until 1503, which shows that the term chaste cardinal was an oxymoron. That was the condition in the leadership of the Roman Church prior to the Reformation. Or Leo X, the pope that was kind of parallel with Luther when Luther came on the scene. And there was one who described Pope Leo X. He said this: "He possessed such charming manners that he would have been a perfect man if he had had some knowledge of religion." Might be helpful for a pope. That was the state of the church pre-Reformation. Horrible. You know, what can happen? What good can come from that? It's the same sort of thing here. Look at this. All the main cast and the leadership of the kingdom. Such a dismal picture. Which I think gives us some low-key encouragement. This tells us, doesn't it, that if God were not preserving his kingdom and his people, they or it would certainly have long ago been swallowed up. So in one sense, even this bleak picture supplies us with a low level, not an enthusiastic level, but a low level of encouragement. Even in conditions like this, God must still be preserving his kingdom, or it would have gone under long before. It's assessing a cast of characters. Now, there's a third matter here. I think the writer wants us to be finding a trace of kingship. Finding a trace of kingship. Now, here I think we have to, when we step back and we look at all of chapter 13 here as a whole, And you have to keep chapter 12, verses 10 to 12 in mind. Look at the background here. Is this simply another godless account of everything that's gone awry? Here's a story. You're in chapter 13. Here's the story of a ruined life. Tamar is left desolate. Story of a ruined life, of sexual fixation and abuse, of crafty minds used for depraved purposes, Jonadab, of volatile but gutless anger, David, of malicious and murderous hatred, Absalom, and so on. It's as if everything has gone pell-mell out of control. It's very hard sometimes to maintain control, isn't it? I don't know if you remember her. I do from fuzzy days long ago. An entertainer by the name of Martha Ray. She was kind of a wild-haired, strange-looking gal. I recall reading in the, I think it was the Jackson, Mississippi Clarion Ledger newspaper about a little over 15 years ago, probably, a notice, a little clip that Martha Ray had died. And she had died, and she left money to PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, all right, the anti-fur organization. But Martha also left her seventh husband, Mark Harris, about $1.5 million. He, in turn, planned to become a fashion designer and to design and market his own line of furs. PETA went ballistic. They said, their director asserted that if Martha Ray would turn over in her grave, if she knew Harris was using her money to finance his furry folly. Well, I don't know what Martha did. Maybe she did turn over in her grave, but she couldn't exercise any control. She had $1.5 million. Mark Harris had it. She had no control. Sometimes we look at this and we say, nobody's in control. It's just going one bump over the log after another. Well, and so you ask yourself, has God then hung a vacancy sign over this chunk of history? Well, it really makes you wonder, as if to underscore that question. Because it's what we've told you before, this is a godless text. There is no mention in all of 2 Samuel 13 of Yahweh. There is no reference, a generic reference to God. There's no reference to the true and living God at all. You have 39 verses without God. But then you have to remember what we just read back in chapter 12 and verses 10 to 12 and what Nathan announced in God's name to David when he said, "And now the sword will not depart from your house forever." And he said, chapter 12, verse 11, "See, I am raising up against you evil from your own house." And that's what you begin to see in chapter 13. Finding a trace of kingship. There it is. So you see what's going on here? If you keep it connected to chapter 12, verse 11, Yahweh is fulfilling his word of judgment against the house of David. Far from these events in chapter 13 indicating that Yahweh's abdicated his kingship, they point to the imposition of his rule. He is bringing his spoken, threatened word to pass. Humanly speaking, everything seems to be unraveling. God's not even mentioned.
But actually, Yahweh is fulfilling his previous word.
It may seem like chaos in chapter 13, but it's a chaos that Yahweh is ruling. Sometimes, you know, you have to find a trace of kingship in your own circumstances, whether meniscal or broadly in history. And I think we always have to remember the pattern in our redemption. The carpenter shop is empty. The cross is empty. The tomb is empty, praise God. But the throne is occupied. In Revelation 4, when John saw his vision in heaven, there was a throne, and one was sitting on the throne. And that's always the case. Our Father, these are not happy, clappy narratives that you give us. In fact, they are sad and sinister ones to a large degree. And yet, in and behind it all, you, the unmentioned God, are fulfilling the word you have spoken. So grant that we would take heart, for it's as if you are careful to show us this, to keep us from despair. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.